Achtung, Panzerwerfer!
Hello, how are we, everybody? This is where, and we're back. We've been having a little bit of a hiatus for a couple of weeks, and and we're back and cooking and ready to roll out. So this is Paul speaking,
and this is Bruce,
and we're here to talk tanks.
We are, and this week the M3 Lee, or if you're a POM, for our POMy listeners, the Grant.
Excellent.
I find that interesting that the Yanks called it after a Confederate general, and the POMs called it after a Union general.
Well, I think the POMs are just being a bit naughty there. But let's kick it off with our... we have to have a mixed national anthem this week. Well, I had to think about it, and I thought, how can I upset both nations at the same time?
As if we're not going to upset them enough.
So let's give it a go, shall we?
Please.
Here we go. I think I've upset
everybody.
You could
just see a Grant going into battle plane, Land of Hope and Glory, couldn't you?
Well, I just thought, pardon me, let me just have a cough. I just thought, well, usually it's the Americans that have got all the bells hanging off sort of thing with their national anthem. So I thought I'd just reverse gears and...
Well, it was nice of you to actually get a brass quintet.
It was a nice quintet.
That was beautiful.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. Look, it's a lovely tune, but it's usually overplayed, I have to say.
Marching bands of football games and things like that.
Yes, but that was a really nice rendition.
It was beautiful. Thought,
oh, yes, I'll have that. We'll have that.
And then there's us.
Oh, you wait until we get the Sentinel, mate. I am going to destroy Australia, mate. Don't worry about that.
All right, let's talk about the M3 Lee / Grant.
Right, okay.
Do you know what M stands for?
Oh, tank.
Well, I didn't know.
I'm just going to keep saying that because one week I'm going to be right.
Well, have a guess.
M.
A lot of the Yank stuff has M in front of it. So British M3, M4, M1A, etc.
Military.
No.
All right, do tell.
Model. You wouldn't
really?
Believe it, would you?
I would not have guessed that. I would have been there for some time.
Model. Wouldn't you have thought it would have been something interesting?
Oh.
Yeah.
Yes, that does
surprise. So it's Model 3 Lee.
Yes. Well, it makes sense. It does make sense.
Yeah. So the M3 Lee was officially a medium tank and it was used during World War II. So in Britain, the tank was called by two names based on the turret configuration and crew size. Tanks employing US pattern turrets were called the Lee, named after the Confederate General Robert E. Lee,
right,
a great general. And variants using the British pattern turrets were known as Grant, named after the Union General Ulysses S. Grant.
He was certainly an effective general.
He was also an excellent general. His buddies weren't. Oh, we shouldn't say that, should we?
Well, I'm thinking the whole... There's quite a kerfuffle over in America about all that sort of stuff. So I think we should probably tread a little lightly on that.
Oh, I'm just talking... I'm
no,
not,
no, I know I'm, what you're
really,
saying. Yes,
I'm just talking about as a general.
Yes, I know. But
the Confederates had some great generals.
They did. Longstreet was my favourite. I thought he was excellent. But he was a little bit like Grant in that Grant... was a bit of a mauler. Like he'd come at you and then he'd hit you from the left and then he'd hit you from the right and he'd just keep chasing you down because he had more soldiers.
Yeah, well, that's right. The thing I liked about the Confederates was they had less to work with.
They did, and they made it work well. And I think they had probably higher morale.
They reminded me of some of those guys reminded me a bit of Rommel, because Rommel had less to work with, but he made good use of what he had. Anyway, we should be talking about tanks.
We
really
did digress somewhat, didn't we? But that's
we
all
haven't
right.
even got through the
we
first,
haven't even haven't got through the introduction. Tanks.
Anyway, we'll just do a bit of an overview. So design commenced in July 1940, and the first M3s were operational in late 41. Mm. So that would have been in time for Africa, basically.
Yep.
So the US Army needed a medium tank armed with a 75mm gun and coupled with the United Kingdom's immediate demand for 3,650 medium tanks, the Lee began production by late 1940. The design was a compromise meant to produce a tank as soon as possible.
Mm.
So if you actually look at the Lee, it looks like a Char B.
It's the same concept.
It's the same concept. So yes. in that it had a 75mm gun in the sponson and it had a pea shooter in the turret.
Yep. But it was tacked together and like bolted in on top of the Mark II.
Yeah. But the reason that they built it this way was because they could build them quickly. And they needed to build them quickly because the Wehrmacht was hammering everything.
It was the Spanish Civil War, actually, that made the Americans originally. I was watching a documentary the other night and about this, and the thing about documentaries is that the language is always very muted, and they'll use euphemisms, and you have to interpret it. You know what I mean? Like the American military had to reassess their tanks after the Spanish Civil War, i.e.
they didn't
pooed
work.
Themselves. They thought, that's not going to work.
they only had the M2, which was basically
the M2 was
a billy cart.
Well, it was the M2 was a response to the Spanish Civil War. Because before that, they had things like the Cunningham and FT-17s and stuff like that. So all they had was like tanks that they could just chuck on the back of a railroad. Carriage and be able to send it across America.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. So the Lee's overall performance was not satisfactory. Sound familiar? And the tank was withdrawn from combat in most theatres as soon as the M4 Sherman became available in large numbers. And there was large numbers of Shermans produced.
But to be fair, it did have a bit of a glory time.
Well, yes. In spite of you know, being not satisfactory, it was considered by Hans von Luck, or Colonel Hans von Luck, or Oberst Hans von Luck, the author of Panzer Commander, whose book I have in my library.
Of course.
To be superior to the best German tank of its time, the Panzer IV, or at least the F1 variant. But that would have been
That's
the short
the
75, yeah.
Yes, yes. So when that high-velocity 75
when
turned
a long 75 appeared, it was over. Yeah. So despite being replaced elsewhere, the British continued to use M3s in combat against the Japanese in Southeast Asia until 1945. Japanese tanks weren't that great.
Now, why do you think that's the case? Because let's face it, they know how to put armour together. I mean, look at some of their battleships that they had before the start of the war. Their engineering was excellent.
Well, the Yamato was...
That's correct.
...was the benchmark until the air arm turned up.
But they did not expect to fight anybody other than the Chinese when they're putting these tanks together. And the Chinese didn't have tanks, period. So all they had to worry about was small arms fire. And that's...
Well, the Japanese invaded Malaya on bicycles.
Well, that's right. And what they wanted was small little tanks that they could stick in small transport ships because that was the majority of their fleet and they could move them around very quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so that's why they turned up with tin cans.
Hmm. Yeah, and also nearly 1,000 M3s were supplied to the Soviets under the Lend-Lease Act. So that's between 41 and 43. But we're going to talk a little bit about that later, but they... I don't think they did too well over there.
Well, I mean, it was a Soviet way. They just like the Matildas. They didn't like the Matildas. They didn't like the Grants. And it was basically because they were just grabbing them and just jamming them into the bloody into the combat, you know, and you're never going to have ideal circumstances. They weren't well-trained crews or anything like that, but, you know, they were just sticking anything they could in front of the Germans to slow them down.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, war came quickly, and I think there's a few countries were caught with their pants down.
Yep.
It's interesting how, Germany invaded, went through Poland and went through France with basically light tanks.
Yes.
But superior tactics.
Superior tactics.
And we've talked about this before.
Oh, and look, they did have very aggressive anti-aircraft guns.
Hmm.
Yes, and they did use them, and they learned how to... That's the thing about the Germans, they're always able to...
Adapt?
Yeah, like if they got
They're like the Borg.
Come on, Bruce. Well, I guess they are in that they come across something new. They'll just, rather than throw their hands up in horror, they've got a very workmanlike ethic about it, and they'll just try and work their way around it. And I think that's a fairly Teutonic trait.
Yeah, but I mean, we've talked about this before, but I know, like with the Germans, like the Luftwaffe was a big player in all this, and I would also go out on a limb and say that their reputation preceded them as well. And I think that sort of, you know...
Well, their reputation was kind of... They had that air of invincibility, but to be fair, they burnished that with the Poland invasion. And the Poles were putting up a good account of themselves right up to the point where the Soviets came in the back door, and then the whole thing just collapsed in and around the Poles because they couldn't sustain it all. But the French is what really set them up in regards to, because the French, as you said last week, they were considered
they were the benchmark army.
Yes.
Although I've been doing some more reading, and the French Air Force was less than adequate. That's why they needed the French had to do a deal with the Brits with the Poms to actually get the RAF which didn't help them. They were valiant in defeat, I guess.
Well, they were. I mean, look, I was trying to say this last week and didn't really get a chance. I mean, the French have traditionally copped a bit of a hiding for their reverse gears.
That's a stupid joke.
Well, it is a stupid joke, but it's funny. But it's unfair because once their government collapsed, I mean, they kind of left them in the lurch. And the French people themselves kept fighting long after the government had given up.
Yeah.
And you can talk...
The French people are awesome. And they fought for their homeland for four years.
And they became very effective in the rear end of the French campaign, which was weeks and weeks after the government had collapsed.
Yeah.
They were given the Germans... hell in southern France.
But the French government was in a state of flux from about 1936 onwards.
I think history will look fairly poorly on Pétain. He was the guy in charge of the government. But like he from the First World War, he was the man who saved Verdun. You know, he was an enormous hero. And once, you know what I mean? When your biggest and best is suddenly fallen over and just thrown up their hands, kind of leaves you with no realistic leader. And I think they were just undone politically rather than, you know, as a fighting nation.
Oh, it's such an interesting piece of history.
It is. So we love you.
Any listeners out there, you really should read some of this history because it's the most interesting piece of history ever.
We do love you, friends. We might make the occasional cheese joke, but we do.
Well, we did the Charbu last week. So.
I think we've put enough apologies.
Anyway,
in there.
We digress. We keep wandering off into the wilderness. Let's get this back on track.
I think that's going to be more of a feature rather than a flaw in this podcast because we're trying to be fun, I guess, more than anything else because there's a lot of
But it's good to try and get some information out too,
make it dry, yes.
Yeah, well.
Yes, if we can make it a little bit.
It's real easy to make it dry.
Oh, it's very
and
easy.
Many, many people do.
Well, we could count the rivets on the side of the tanks if you want that level of detail, boys and girls, but I don't think you do.
Not from us. No. Not in an Australian lounge room.
No, good Lord, no.
No. Anyway, look, we'll quickly do a little bit about the development because I'm not going to dwell on that because I get chastised for that if I dwell on that too much.
Just a quick summary.
So this is an interesting fact. In 1939, the US Army possessed approximately 400 tanks, mostly M2 light tanks.
Yep.
So they only had 400 tanks.
Depression.
Well, that's nearly 20 years previous. So, 10 years.
No, yeah. It's only 10 years. And they were only just clawing out of the Depression in like 36, 37. Mm. And it was only when Roosevelt got in and then put massive works. And I think Hoover also got in there. And
There was a big kerfuffle at about 36. They tried some to limit arms, and there was a big thing on naval power.
Yep.
And the Poms and the Yanks and the French, I think, got together, and they were limiting the amount of tonnage that you could have in your navy.
Yeah.
And I think the Yanks saw it as, the Brits are trying to outdo us. You know, like the Brits had the most powerful navy in the world at that stage. And they did right up until after the Second World War, I think. I could be wrong.
If you were the French or the Americans or even the Germans, you'd want to try and limit everybody's tonnage because your nation's entire yearly GDP with one torpedo would go to the bottom of the sea. They're massively expensive.
It did. Yeah, yeah. Actually, the one that was driving the naval arms race was the Japanese.
They were naughty.
Anyway. Yes. But, you know. So they only had 400 tanks. And 18 of the soon-to-be-discontinued M2 tanks were the only ones considered to be modern. So the tanks that they had were the ones that were developed in the interwar years between, like, the end of the First World War into the Second. So they would have been basically, I don't know, tractors with guns.
Who's this? The
Americans.
The Americans. Mm. Well, they had the T1 Cunningham, which was their first tank. I think they did that in the early 20s.
The Richie Cunningham. Did have red hair.
That's in World of Tanks. That's a remarkably good little tank, you know. It's a lot of fun. But anyway, we digress. And they had a couple of other variants, and they mainly did it off the British six tonners. Which were just light tanks, and they did variations on that.
Yeah, well, the M2, we're talking about, was typical of armoured fighting vehicles of many nations produced in 1939. When the US entered the war, the M2 design was already obsolete, so it had a 37mm gun, an impractical number of secondary machine guns, and a very high silhouette, so it was basically a target.
But it was an excellent trainer.
And had 32mm of frontal armour. Mm. Wow. Inch and a half, which
is about
inch and a half.
Yeah, I know it's not a lot, but a lot of the Germans didn't have anything better.
Yeah,
like the Panzer III only had 35, I think, from memory.
Yeah, well, the Panzer III and Panzer IV's success in the French campaign led the US Army to immediately order a new medium tank armed with a 75mm gun in a turret as a response. Mm. That would be the Sherman, the M4 Sherman.
Yep.
But until the Sherman reached production, an interim design with a 75mm gun was urgently needed. So that was the M3.
Yep. It was a stopgap.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
The design was unusual because the main weapon, the medium velocity 75mm gun, so it wasn't a high velocity, it was only a...
No.
It was a howitzer, I guess.
Better than a howitzer? Medium velocity. A low velocity is like a howitzer.
Well, the Shah B had a howitzer, didn't it? It was a short barrel, a shorter barrel, wasn't it?
Yes. I think it
looked like a man of war cannon.
It did a bit.
Here come the Portuguese.
Put the pirate flag up on top of the Sharpie and away they go.
Yeah. So the thing was that it was actually offset in the sponson.
Yep.
Mounted in the hull with limited traverse. So the sponson mount was necessary because at the time, American tank plants didn't have the design experience necessary to make the gun turret capable.
Mm.
So there you go. So a small turret with a lighter, high velocity 37mm gun sat on top of a tall hull, and it was tall.
Mm. Very tall.
Yeah.
Mm.
I mean, you're looking against, say, even a Panzer III, and it was way taller.
Yeah. And the problem was because the 75 was so low, set so low into the hull, they couldn't go into a hull down situation.
That's exactly right.
You know,
so that was not, and with a high profile, a high silhouette, and you can't get into hull down. I don't think it wouldn't be a lot of fun.
Well, it was their first attempt, so give them credit, you know.
Oh, I guess.
You know, they didn't realise that that was going to be a critical issue. I mean, even in Desert War, you can still, there was a lot of opportunity for hull down fighting.
So, yeah, but there was like a small cupola on top of the turret, had a machine gun.
Yep.
So the two main guns were seen on the French Charby, which we dealt with last week, and the Mark I version of the Churchill. Mm. Oh, there you go. Yeah, how about that? In each case, two weapons were mounted to give the tanks adequate capability in firing both anti-personnel high explosive, and canister ammunition. Canister. That brings back the Napoleonic days, doesn't it?
It does.
Load with canister.
Splintex.
Oh.
Yeah, it's anti-personnel shells.
Yeah, and so, and it also had armor-piercing ammunition for anti-tank combat.
For the uninitiated, it essentially turns it into a giant shotgun.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it's shrapnel.
Yep.
Yeah, so so the M3 differed slightly from this pattern, having the main gun that could fire an armor-piercing projectile at a velocity high enough for effectively piercing armor, as well as deliver a high explosive shell that was large enough to be effective. Mm. So they could actually fire an anti-tank round out of the 75, which would be... That would hurt. Yeah.
Well, it was quite like something like a Mark III. It was devastating, you know.
Oh, yeah.
It took them to pieces. For sure.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Well, yeah.
That's why the Poms and the Aussies liked it so much when it first turned up, because all they had at that stage of the game was the two-pounder. Or should I say, in British parlance, the two bloody pounder.
Oh, jeez.
You know, because, yeah. Finally, they had something that could, you know, do some decent damage. Yeah.
So the 75mm gun was operated by a gunner and a loader. So there was a two-man crew.
Yep.
Sighting the gun used an M1 periscope with an integral periscope on the top of the sponson. So there was actually a periscope. The aiming mechanism was on top of the sponson. The periscope rotated with the gun. The sight was marked from 0 to 3,000 yards or 2,700 metres.
Yep.
With vertical markings to aid deflection, shooting at a moving target. The gunner laid the gun on target through geared hand wheels for traversing elevation. So it was basically windy-windy.
Yep.
Windy-windy. Mm. Which would be... That'd be cool. I reckon that's be a good way of doing it. When you think about it.
Oh, for small increments.
I've got to remember this is a radio thing. I'm actually... doing the windy thing.
I know, I was watching. It's all
yeah, good. I know. I'm just thinking people are going, the hell is he doing?
Hold your hands up to the microphone. That'll do it better. We will get this videotaped eventually. We'll get organised.
Ah, that's interesting. The shorter-barreled 75mm M2 cannon sometimes featured a counterweight at the end of the barrel to balance the gun for operation with the gyro stabiliser until the longer 75mm M3 variant was brought into use.
Ah,
so there was a counterweight on it.
So they used basically the same technology that they were using out of those British... You know those sponson guns that in the
First
Mark
World
Fives?
War. Yeah, First World War.
Yeah, they were naval guns we've got, with basic gyroscopes on them.
That's interesting, isn't it? So the 37mm gun was aimed through the M2 periscope mounted in the mantlet to the side of the gun. So it was actually...
Yep.
Next to it. It also sighted the coaxial machine gun. Two range scales were provided for the 37mm and for the machine gun. So the 37mm gun also featured a counterweight.
Right.
Wow. A long rod under the barrel, though it was still maintained by crews who... I think I remember reading somewhere that when the Germans actually first came across the Lee...
Mm-hmm.
Even though it was more than a match for the Mark III's and Mark IV's, that they were a bit aghast at the technology.
Yep.
They expected the American technology to be more advanced than what that was.
Mm.
And I guess when the Sherman turned up, that was probably manifested itself as
the
something
British,
else.
But this is it. The British had been in war for, what was this now, 1941? By the stage of the game?
Yeah.
The British effectively had been war since September 1939. effectively, they started in France in 1940. So they'd been at war for at least a full year, and that they've already learnt a lot of lessons. And the stuff that they turned up with first wasn't any better. You look at the Matilda One. You know, it was completely pointless to have it there on the field.
Which was proved yeah, in France.
Absolutely. And so, you know, for them to then, how soon we forget, you know, you do not learn those lessons until it's paid in blood. So, yeah. But anyway, all good.
I guess we probably should talk about the difference between the Lee and the Grant, because we have been talking about Lees and Grants.
Yes.
So the difference was the British desired modifications for the tank they were purchasing because they were desperately short. A bustle rack was to be made at the back of the turret to house wireless set number 19. That's just great, isn't it? The turret was to be given thicker armour plate than the original US design, and the machine gun cupola was to be replaced with a simple hatch. So they didn't want the cupola on the top.
Yep.
It's funny that Germans actually put cupolas in tanks. Like they captured T-34s and they actually installed cupolas in the top of them.
Yep. But so. I guess the British looked at the height of the tank and thought, you know, it might be something as simple as the tank simply wouldn't have gone through the tunnels on the railroad in Britain.
Railway.
Whatever they're called. You're the railroad guy.
Railway.
That's right. So that's what I mean. It might have been simple that it might have been like, you know, 12... inches too high sort of thing.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
For clearances.
Who'd know? Extended space within the turret of the new M3 also allowed the use of a smoke bomb launcher. So they had smoke launchers on these things, yeah. Yep. Although the addition of the radio would take the space for storage of 50 37mm rounds. So they put the radio in and they took 50 rounds of ammo out.
I'm not saying a word.
No.
No, well, I think communication
at least they, was key. At least these ones could fire high explosives.
They may not have had the bullets to shoot, but at least they were able to say, all right, let's get out of here.
So the ammunition capacity is reduced to 128 rounds.
Yep.
There you go. So several of these new Grant tanks would also be equipped with sand shields for action in North Africa.
Yep.
Though they often fell off.
Gee, right here.
Obviously, so works well.
Are they the little flappy things that would flop down over the front of the road wheels?
Except with the tracks, are running over, and they just sort of. Yep. But wouldn't they just fill up with sand?
Well, they probably got caught with stones and things like that, and just rip them off, I guess.
Jeez. So, with these modifications accepted, the British ordered 1,250 M3s. Mm. So, which was a big order. The order was subsequently increased with the expectation that when the M4 Sherman was available, it could replace part of the order.
I was just thinking, and they probably finished the last payment for them in 1975.
Oh, I think it was about 1995. Contracts were arranged with three US companies. The total cost of the order was approximately $240 million US.
Mm. Rubbing their hands, they were.
The sum of all British funds in the US. It took the US Lend-Lease Act to solve the financial shortfall. So there you go. Isn't that interesting?
Mm. So how'd they go?
Well, yeah, they didn't do too badly, I think, from what I can tell. I know that the Germans got a bit of a shock when they first turned up.
Mein Gott.
So, mein Gott. Mm. Gott und Himmel, or Scheitzen.
Oh, by the way, hi to our German listeners, because we've got German listeners.
Oh, do we?
Oh, we do.
Oh, fantastic.
I'll have to show you the map later.
Guten Abend.
We're spread across the world like the British Empire we are. We've only been going for about 3 weeks, and we've got people from just about every continent.
Hey, listen, Paul, I can impress them with the only bit of, well, most of the Deutsche that I do know is military.
Yep.
But the only bit that I used when I travelled to Germany was Ich möchte ein zwei Bier bitte. And that unlocked lots of doors. Can I have two beers, please?
Yes. Now you've got to learn how to order your beer. That's for sure. Yep.
Yeah. Anyway. So we just talk a little bit about the operational history, just a little bit.
Yep.
So, of the 6,258 M3 variants manufactured in the United States, 2,855 or 45% were officially handed over to the British government.
Yep.
So they were basically making them for export. Mm. The M3 Grant first saw action with the Royal Armour Corps in North Africa during May 1942, not 1941. Yeah.
They did... So that was the first export,
action.
Was it?
Yeah.
Oh, no, that was the first action.
Yeah, first action.
Right. Because I think they started building up at Alamein.
El Alamein, yeah.
Yeah, on the first when they got pushed back.
Yep. Mm. Yeah. So, but however, most of the M3s ordered by the UK quickly became surplus to requirements of the British Army. Guess where 1,700 of those went?
Here?
Yeah. Mm. Straight to us, yeah.
Yes.
For home defence and training duties.
Well, they do train a lot of people. They got the crew of five, didn't
well,
they?
Well, the Indian Army got 900 of them and a further 1,386
now, I'd like
were
to
exported
talk about,
directly to the US,
I'd like
to Soviet
talk
Union.
About the Indian grants because there's quite an interesting story that I've picked up.
Oh, good.
Yeah,
please
so,
do.
Yeah. Well, do you want me to do it now?
Yeah, well, we'll be talking
all,
about
all right. Okay, so... Well, those ones that got sent there, they had to defend India. The Japanese were coming through Burma. And, of course, the Japanese were essentially running with infantry and air attacks and these little tinky little, you know, two-man tankettes.
Which we will deal with.
Well, we will have to because
well, I'd like
they're interesting vehicles,
yes,
nonetheless.
Indeed.
Yes, mm. And, like, they were instrumental in a lot of victories. The other side didn't have any tanks, but they were instrumental. No, well, they were because, look, you look at Singapore. Where were the tanks there? None. You know, they just rolled up with these things and the British had their 303s and thought, what are we going to do now?
We were there.
Well, that's right. But anyway, so they rolled up, they crossed over Burma and, of course, it's pretty torturous terrain. And the very fact that they were getting these tanks over that terrain was, you know, a mark of absolute, persistence. I can't think of anything better than that at the moment. I'm sorry, boys and girls. But anyway, so they came across these jungle mountains and then they came down into the Bangladesh area sort of thing and they were faced off against these massive grants. And, the 75mm just tore great chunks through them.
Hmm.
Now, there was a couple of times where the Japanese pulled back and they would sit and wait in ambush. And these little pokey little tanks that they had actually destroyed quite a few grants because they would hide them in the jungles and they'd attack them at point-blank range out of the jungle on the side. They'd wait for them to drive past.
That's brave.
Yeah, well, suicidal. But this is what the Japanese were...
Banzai.
You know, and they just did banzai charges of their tanks. You know, and the first couple of times, very effective. The Grants turned around and they raced off out of there. And then, of course, they just turned around and then just opened up on the surviving Japanese tanks. Because when they hit them from the side, they realised that they couldn't turn that 75mm onto
them. Sponsor, yeah.
And they're at least in with a half a chance, only up against the 37mm sort of thing. So, but yeah, they were monstrous tanks compared to what the Japanese were running with.
Mm, of course.
And so the Japanese then had the problem of how are we going to get rid of these things? And of course, being Japanese, they would get individual soldiers and they'd strap satchel charges to them and the Japanese soldiers would simply run out. Jump underneath the tank and then let rip and up goes the tank.
Did the Japanese use Molotovs? I don't know if they did.
No, well, they had plenty of not C4, but they had plenty of
plastic
explosives and they used it
to
great effect.
That'd do it.
So what happened was the British had to start retraining Marines and wherever the tanks went, they had to have these, and it was a dangerous job, but they got very, very good at grenadiers, I should say, not Marines, I don't know what I was thinking, grenadiers who was on the front line right up there next to the tank sort of thing and they had to spread out and as soon as a Japanese soldier would run out, out of cover and try and jump underneath the Grant, one or two things. If they could get in underneath quickly and deploy, the tank would go up. If they didn't get shot by the grenadiers, or they developed a tactic very quickly that as soon as they saw one coming, they'd immediately drop the tank into reverse and just keep reversing back. And of course, the Japanese, and of course, they could, and they'd half ruin the gearboxes half the time, you know, because they'd just see a guy running.
That's slamming into reverse.
Yeah, because they had these great big boxes on them, and they couldn't run that fast, you know, because they had these boxes of explosives strapped to them. And they'd run towards a tank, and they'd just slam it into reverse and back straight up. And
too bad if you're the supporting infantry behind the tank.
Oh, well, the supporting infantry was there to support the tanks. You know, that was the whole point of having the grenadiers, because the Japanese were using these kamikaze, if I can just borrow the term, but they weren't called that.
Hmm.
So it was a very, very cutthroat and bloodthirsty. And may I say, the Burma campaign doesn't get a lot of recognition. Like, it tends to get forgotten, but it was a hard fight.
Oh, yeah.
It was a very hard fight for both sides, anyway. So, yes.
Was that the Chindits? Is that the British Chindits?
Yes, yes.
They dropped them. They did what the French tried to do at Dien Bien Phu.
Yep.
They dropped them in behind the Japanese lines and resupplied them from the air.
Yep. And there was a couple of officers who were just using local soldiers sort of thing.
Yeah, they used the local men, which was... really interesting stuff.
Well,
brutal.
It was a very harsh war. It was a very harsh war. And, you know, it's well worth investigating, because it's not one that people really know very much about. And
I mean, if you do any reading on any of those battles in the islands, so particularly like Tarakan, or it's just horrible.
Yep.
It's just horrible. I mean, we as Australians, we sort of tend to focus on Kokoda, which... was really interesting. Like, that was what we call the chocos, like the chocolate soldiers. So they were the weekend warriors. They were the guys. They weren't even...
No, they were just militia.
They were militia against the unit in the Japanese Marines, which was the, you know, they were... And they were brutal, and yet our blokes stopped them.
Well, that's it. They were left... And I think the terrain massively helped in that you can't bring a massive force of professional soldiers to bear because, you know...
But they're well equipped. The Japanese are well equipped. I mean, they had mountain guns. They had, you know...
They did.
They had pack howitzers and stuff. So they brought their artillery with them.
Yep.
Whereas we dragged a couple of 25-pounders...
Oh, you're talking about the Kokoda here,
yeah,
right?
Kokoda, yeah. We dragged a couple of 25-pounders up a mountainside. Yep.
Broke them down and...
Yep. Well, no, they dragged them.
They had to drag the whole
thing. They dragged the whole thing up. Yeah, hold the spoilers.
Yep.
But anyway, we digress. Oh, surprise. one thing that we're just talking about, the Lend-Lease lease.
Yep.
They sent 1,386, but only 976 got there. U-boats and air. They're all at the bottom of the Baltic. I bet they're still there.
And you know what? They'd be in very good condition.
Yeah. So the M3s actually fought in North Africa because the British forces needed some firepower, and they really didn't have that.
Yep.
I mean, so what were they? Were they cruiser tanks and things like that? So
The Covenanter and the what was another one? Before the Comets or any of them, because they were quite
Comet. Comet was a version of the.
They had the cruiser Mark IIs and things like
that. Yeah, they were light. They were lighter.
Yeah.
Christie suspension. They were and they were quick. And they used to fire broadsides. They used to
and
fire
awful. Don't forget the awful bit. They were quite bad. We'll get into them, and we won't hold back on them because they were dreadful tanks.
Yeah, we'll get there.
Yep.
There's a few others I want to get to before them. So. So the first tank action of the M3 was in 1942. I think we touched on this before, and that was against Africa Corps, so Rommel.
Yep.
Their appearance, as we've said, was a surprise to the Germans, who were unprepared for the M3 75 millimeter gun. They soon discovered that the M3 could engage them beyond the effective range of their. Yeah, 50mm Pak 38s,
yep,
and the 50mm KWK 39 on the Panzer III, so which was their main medium tank.
Yep.
The M3 was also vastly superior to the Fiat M13/40, really.
Yep.
And the M1441 tanks employed by the Italian troops, whose 47mm gun was effective only at point-blank range. Oh, that would have been a surprise.
I know everybody loves hacking on the Italian tanks, but I'm going to defend the Italian tanks just momentarily. Where do you think that they, when they designed these tanks, where do you think they were going to fight them? They were going to fight them in the mountains.
Yeah.
And, you know, they thought that they'd need light, agile tanks.
Yeah, but what about the 720? The 720 mm-hmm. self-propelled guns are able to destroy the M3 using heat rounds.
So, wow!
So high explosive anti-tank rounds. So the, those
ranges does it say or?
Well, they outrange. No, they didn't outrange them, but I'm guessing.
Yeah.
Toe to toe.
Yep. And they looked a little Stug-like, didn't they? From
well, that's what they were, yes. Basically. So they're basically a self-propelled gun.
Yep.
So that's interesting, isn't it?
Mm. Put a dirty, great big gun in a.
I read that the premier outfits in the Italian army were the Artillery, and they were really nasty.
Yes.
They were very good.
Very good.
But they fought to the end. They didn't muck around.
No, look, once the Italians were under Rommel, there was quite a few units that fought, you know, first class. I think they had to learn the lessons. I mean, let's face it, all they had for in war experience before that was the First World War, and then they went to Abyssinia, which is now Ethiopia, and they got their backsides handed to them there in one particular battle. But then they hadn't learnt the lessons, you know, hard yet. Hadn't paid in blood, and by the time that they were ready to go, in the Second World War, they were more of a show army rather than a, you know, an actual fighting combat unit sort of thing.
Yeah, that's true. So, but in addition to the M3 75mm gun outranging the Panzers, they're equipped with high explosive shells to take out infantry and other soft targets. So, artillery guns like MGs. Which previous British tanks lacked. Why wouldn't they put HE in their tanks? It just belies...
Who, the Germans?
The British.
The British. Oh, bloody-mindedness, perhaps? I don't know. Like, you'd think maybe... Well, I don't have an answer for it. You'd have to ask them. You know, because...
Maybe we should ask them.
Maybe we should make that... You know what? Why don't you talk to your friends at Bovington and just go, come on, guys, fess up. Why?
I will.
Reach out and see what kind of answer
I might get a word from the Australian Army first and see what their take on it was.
Well, they'll be biased.
Excellent.
in the name of fairness, get it from both.
Actually, there's a quote here from Field Marshal Rommel. Yep. And he says, up to May of 1942, our tanks had in general been superior in quality to the corresponding British types. This was now no longer true, at least not to the same extent. So the Lee made an impact. It really did.
Yep.
Yeah. So despite the M3's advantages and surprise appearance during the Battle of Gazala, it could not win the battle for the British. In particular, the high velocity... 88mm flak, our old friend, adapted as an anti-tank gun, proved deadly if British tanks attacked without artillery support. And they did.
And they were big targets.
Oh, I can remember reading about the Battle of El Alamein and the Matilda, it was Matilda tanks, also a big target. And just moving across and then they just started to explode and they couldn't figure out why they were exploding and... The Africa Corps had 88s hidden and they were shooting them at 2 kilometres or something. It was some 2,000 metres. It was just unbelievable.
Reaching out and touching them.
Yeah, hello.
There's an old grant over in North Bandiana and I'm going to go over there. It's a little bit... It's a wreck essentially now because I think it spent a fair bit of its time in Puckapunyal playing tag with Leopard tanks.
Target practice.
So it's not in good order. I might take a few shots and put it up on the website just so people can see an old girl that's been left out. It's just rusty and it's essentially just the hole.
We should take a picture and put it up on our site.
That I was just saying.
I know.
Yes.
I wasn't listening.
No, that's usually the case, but yes, that's all right. That's
okay. Anyway, let's keep moving. The M3 was generally appreciated during the North African campaign for its mechanical reliability, good armour protection and heavy firepower. In all three aspects, the M3 was capable of engaging German tanks and towed anti-tank guns.
Yep.
However, its high silhouette and low hull-mounted 75mm were tactical drawbacks since they prevented fighting from a hull-down firing position, as you said before. In addition, the use of riveted hull superstructure armour on the early versions... Oh, imagine the spalling inside. That would be just awful. Horrendous. Mm. Oh, yeah. Where the impact of enemy shells caused the rivets to break off and become projectiles inside the tank. So later models were built with an all-welded armour to eliminate this problem. These lessons had already been applied to the design and production of the M4.
The Sherman. Yep.
Yeah. So it's kind of interesting.
Lessons learnt.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the Soviets used, they had a few of them.
They had their lessons learnt. But
they preferred, what am I trying to say? So like the British Commonwealth units, the Soviet Red Army personnel tended to refer to the M3 as the Grand, even though all the M3s shipped to Russia were technically Lees.
Yep.
But they didn't like the Confederate general, maybe. Who would know?
I don't think it was something they really gave it a lot of thought to. Yeah. Probably not.
Yeah. Yeah, so...
Well, it would have...
I mean, they had about 900 of these things.
The stuff would have got shipped... You see, this is it. The stuff would have got shipped to Britain and then from there shipped from Britain to Russia. And so the British would have been in charge of it, and the Russian says, "What tank is this?" And they go, "Oh, it's a Lee."
Well, I mean, the Soviets were building 1,500 T-34s a month.
Yep.
So the use of the M3 medium tank declined soon after mid-1943. Soviet troops still fielded their Grant tanks on secondary and quieter, less action fronts such as the Arctic region during the Red Army's offensive against German forces in Norway in October 1944, where the then obsolete US tanks faced mainly captured French tanks. So that's interesting. That'd be an interesting battle used by the Germans. So that, such as the Samoa S-35. We should do a thing on the Samoa. That's pretty interesting too. So, and then they were used in the Pacific War. So they were mainly sort of... against the Japanese. Well, that is the Pacific War, isn't it?
Yeah.
So they were sort of used in limited capacity there. And then the British used them in Burma, as we spoke about before. Yep. So, and then there's us.
So, all right, I braced myself. What have we done to them?
Well,
fencing wire.
I've seen a lot of them used as tractors, actually. There's farmers use them as bulldozers.
I'm ready for it, Bruce. What have we got?
Oh, not a whole lot. It's just at the beginning of the war, the Australian Army doctrine viewed tank units as minor offensive components within infantry divisions.
Of course.
Who does that sound like? That's not how we used them in the first war. We used them as
Well, we didn't have tanks of our own.
We used everybody else's.
Yeah, well, we were the shock troops. We just ran in behind the tanks or, you know, and then deployed out from behind them.
Yeah. But by early 1941, the effectiveness of large-scale German panzer attacks had been recognised. Well, duh. Mm. Yeah, and a dedicated armouring mustering was formed. So that's the Australian Armour Corps, et cetera, et cetera. So... But by the middle of the war, the Australian Army had deemed the Grant to be unsuitable for combat duties. Well, I think we were using Matildas, weren't we? We used Matildas
through. We liked them more.
Yeah.
Yeah. The crews probably liked them more because, let's face it,
but the gun on the Matilda, as we know, was...
I've been putting together a little movie about the Matilda, and I've got some footage of them operating in the jungle. And because of their slow speed and everything, you'd think the Matilda was... quite cumbersome, but it was actually like I got one fording into a river and coming out the other side. Not at all. It was quite capable of getting in and getting out. Yeah.
Yeah. I've seen one going around a paddock up north of here, and the actual gun sort of stuck. It's sort of depressed and over to the left, but it's still the tank's actually still operating pretty well. Mm. Yeah. So by the middle of the war, the Grant was unsuitable for combat duties, but they did deploy him in New Guinea, Borneo, and some other places over in the islands. Yep. So which is kind of interesting. So following the end of the war, 14 of the Australian Grants were converted to a local self-propelled gun design, the Yeramba. So this is the only self-propelled gun that the Australian Army ever had.
Right.
So it was basically, they cut the top off it.
What did they put in it?
25-pound a field gun.
Oh, God. Okay. But that's not really
but they were actually but they weapon, the Yarambas actually remained in service with the 22nd Field Regiment, Royal Australian Artillery, until the late 1950s.
Really?
But yeah. Well, isn't that interesting?
It is. It is. What do we have then? Well, we had Centurions would have been coming in.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's why you'd get rid of them.
Oh, well, when you got we only had them. They cut them up and used them as SPGs.
Put them out and then retire them out to the pucker range.
So there you go. So that's basically the M3. So I mean, overall, can we just recap?
Yep.
So overall, the M3 was able to be effective on the battlefield from 1942 until 1943. Yep. So it had a very small window of opportunity.
Okay. So from all of your research and everything, you've gone through it and looked at it. What is your opinion of it? Do you think it was a successful tank, you know, considering everything?
For what it was, basically a stopgap, they needed to produce it quickly. They needed to get them onto the field.
Yep.
And they could go toe-to-toe with that German armour.
Yep, you know. Mark III's.
But until, in mid-1942, you had the introduction of the Tiger I.
Yep.
Which, no.
No.
No, 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 that ain't going to happen. And the upgunning of the Panzer IV.
Yes.
So with long-barreled 75.
Yes.
And in 1943, oh, dear God, you had the first appearance of the Panther.
Yes.
No. You had no hope.
That was the end of that.
Yeah.
Yep.
So at the same time, the Sherman was coming along in great numbers, so the Lee was done.
Look, I agree with you. I think it was a success because it did what it was supposed to do. It was a stopgap, you know, and it was there purely just until they could get the Shermans up and rolling.
Yeah.
And it stopped the Germans in North Africa.
Well, yeah. I mean, but you think about they used the actual chassis of it, which is probably quite good. I mean, the M7 Priest, so that the self-propelled gun that was basically a Lee chassis. The M12 had a 155mm howitzer on it.
Yep.
So that was they used them as tank recovery vehicles. They used them as other things for whatever. So the British had a number of variants. They had an armoured recovery vehicle. They had a command tank. They had used one as a Scorpion. There was a Scorpion 3 and a Scorpion 4, which were basically a mine flail tanks. They had the flails on the top.
So they took those the same flails that they used on the Matildas, and they used them on the Grants as well. Yeah.
They took the 75 off and they used
them. I would have thought.
Yeah, yeah. And there was a couple of things like canal defence lights. But
I wouldn't have thought the underbelly of a Grant would be anywhere near as thick as a Matilda.
Who'd know? And it's all it's doing is the flails out in front of the thing.
Well, yes, but will they get everything?
Well, hopefully.
You're hoping
you wouldn't want to be sitting in the front hoping. You'd be,
Yep.
But that's, I mean, it's like everything else. They repurposed them and reused them, so...
Yep. Yep. But, that's excellent. All right. Well, next week, what have we got?
Oh, one of my favourites.
Your favourites.
Not the favourite, but one of my favourites. The Panzer III.
The Panzer III. Now, are we going to be talking about all the variants or are you
going to we'll talk about some of them, I guess. But there's so many. I mean, there's Stugs.
Yes.
There's all sorts of things.
Other than the Mark IV, which the Mark IV would, to do it justice, you're just about to have to do a double episode, and I think people would be well and truly sick of it by then.
Oh, they're probably sick of it now. We're still talking about it. Yeah, but the Mark III was awesome. Yep. I just reckon I love the look of them. I reckon they're just fantastic.
And they were very versatile in other roles.
For what
as
they
well.
Were, they were so far ahead. Mm. They were so far ahead, I guess. You know, people say, oh, why did they bother doing it when they could have made Mark IVs? But Mark IIIs are probably, I think you'll find that they're easy to produce in mass, in great quantities. Yep. So,
all right. Okay. Well, that's terrific, Bruce. Well, until next week, it's goodbye from him.
And goodbye from me.